Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. All this week, we've been talking about noise and how you deal with it. Our cities are noisy, our homes are noisy, our neighbors are noisy. Some of those neighbors are musicians. They're paid to be noisy. And so they practice and practice. And, well, what would you do?
I know of one case where a neighbor even tried to poison the person. Yeah, they left them something to eat at the door. Said, you should try this, it's a great... And it was poisoned. Yeah.
That's pianist Seymour Bernstein. We'll hear from him and other folks on how to deal with a musician's need to practice and their neighbor's need not to go crazy or to prison. And we'll visit with guitarist Marnie Stern as she plays in her living room while the neighbors are out. And we'll hear violinist and singer Marquise Tolliver playing live here in our soundproofed studio where we won't bother anyone. But first, the cicadas are coming. Yes, the 17-year cicada swarm is about to emerge here in the Northeast, and whether you want to or not, you will soon be thinking of the sound of the insect world around us. Well, musician and philosopher David Rothenberg has actually beaten you to it. He's been thinking about the sounds of cicadas and other insects, and how those sounds have influenced human music over the years. It's the subject of his new book and accompanying CD called Bug Music. David, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you've done birds and whales, both of whom are, you know, animals or groups of animals we think of as very songful groups. Why complete your trilogy with insects?
Well, there's really nowhere else to go, in a sense. And also, the trilogy would not be complete without delving into the most ancient, the most thrumming, the most rhythmic, really the background of perhaps all music in nature is the hum of these millions of species of creatures, where each one is like a tiny intelligence, and they make a music, one little part together, making a whole that's more than what any individual could think of.
So the subtitle of the book, Bug Music, How Insects Gave Us Rhythm and Noise, do we as a species and do other animals that sing get a sense of rhythm from this kind of soundscape around us from these insects?
We might have. I mean, the usual evolutionary psychology explanations of why people like rhythm talk about the gait, human gait, a certain pace. They talk about the human heartbeat as the source of rhythms. But like all such things, it's all pure conjecture. And no doubt when humans were thinking about music and feeling a sense of beat and noise around us, insects were everywhere in the rainforest, in the savanna, all the places we were evolving. And when they are out in full force, you cannot ignore this thrumming sense of sound.
But is it music?
Is it music? Of course it's music.
Why?
I've always believed these kinds of sounds that animals make, where often the males are making a sound to attract the attention of females to notice that they are there, they are just working the way music works. They don't work the way language works. Sound, a similar thing, is repeated over and over and over again. As you know from all that you've been listening to here, when we have a hit song, we want to hear it over and over and over again. We don't need the message again and again. We need that music. We need the feel. We need the thrum, the tone, the buzz, the noise. And this is how insect sounds work, bird songs.
Now, in addition to kind of exploring the sounds that insects themselves make, as you've done with your previous books, you include a CD, much of which involves actual field recordings of the insects, and then you and, in one case at least, your son going out and sort of playing with the insects.
That's right. I've always believed that as a musician, you just have to go out there and try and make music with these sounds live to really understand what's happening. And this, I think, many more musicians should be doing, not just sampling bits of natural sound, taking it home and manipulating it, turning it into anything. Just get out there in the midst of something strange and make some music. I've been playing clarinet, bass clarinet with cicadas here. I've got my friend Timothy Hill from the Harmonic Choir doing overtone singing along with katydids. And then it was my son who figured out how to play the iPad live along with cicadas to the greatest possible effect.
And his name is?
Umru, U-M-R-U.
Okay.
It's a pseudo-Estonian name, like Arvo, except we had to make it up.
So he's playing the iPad, you're playing the clarinet, and the brood of cicadas in Lexington, Virginia, which came out last year in 2012, providing the rest of the sounds. A little bit of the music on the CD that accompanies David Rothenberg's latest book called Bug Music, How Insects Gave Us Rhythm and Noise. Do you think the cicadas noticed what you guys were doing?
I would say they definitely noticed the iPad, because in certain sounds, when it began to swell the way their song started to swell, they would fly onto it and go, and they'd have a light right next to it. Yeah, and you know, we know cicadas are responding to very specific things. That, you know, three related species come out at the same time, and one of them synchronizes in washes of white noise going shh. The other species has this more tonal pharaoh sound. Pharaoh, pharaoh. I think we'll have more of those up here in the next few weeks, although we will have a mix of both of them.
Mm-hmm. These are the 17-year cicadas, but there are 13-year cicadas as well?
Yes, the 13-year ones basically sound the same, although they come out this other prime-numbered cycle, and they do not mate with each other. So
okay.
They're separate species.
So cicadas, I mean, you cover many, many different insects in the book, but cicadas are kind of a theme that takes us through the story of Bug Music. They are, you know, very much in the news because we're expecting the Northeast to be hearing and seeing them again next month. How do they make their sound, and what do we think they intend by that sound? Is it simply to mate?
Well, cicadas don't make their sound by rubbing their legs or wings. They have an organ on the side of their abdomen called a timbal. It's like a round thing, like the head of a drum. They vibrate. And the cicadas that come out every year also have these. And this is this device that's able to make this loud, incredibly gigantic sound.
Not everyone's going to want to go wading out among these bugs with instruments in hand. But the idea that insects might actually sort of respond to what we do, as opposed to us responding to what they do, is an interesting one. And you write in the book about David Dunn, the scientist who's also a composer himself, doing work with these bark beetles.
David Dunn is a composer who figured out how to listen inside of trees because he likes making DIY microphones. And he made a microphone with a meat thermometer and some piezoelectric discs and stuck it inside a tree. And he heard these amazing sounds. Now, these bark beetles in the American West are destroying hundreds of thousands of acres of trees, and we have no idea what to do about this. It's doing huge amounts of damage. It has something to do with the warming temperature of the planet. They're just not dying in the winter. They're destroying more and more and more. And until he listened inside the tree, no one realized that they had a complex acoustic life. You don't just hear them munching. You hear them communicating to each other. And after that, he got the idea, well, let's play them some sounds and see how they're listening, what we can do to them. And when he played the sounds of rival beetle species that weren't supposed to be in that kind of tree, the beetles would start to attack each other, just do crazy things. He even played the voice of Rush Limbaugh. But he says there's too much coverage of that in the media. We probably shouldn't have done that. He just wanted a kind of loud, harsh voice to see what that would do to them. In fact, we have little idea what's really doing to them, and there's hardly any way you could imagine using this technique to make a difference in the population, because you'd have to play so much music into all these different trees we really don't know what to do about it. But once Dunn discovered the sounds were going on, now there's a whole scientific field of bark beetle acoustic communication going on.
The idea that you can not only disrupt their communication but get these pests, which is what they are in this situation, to turn on each other simply through sound is a really kind of unusual idea and potentially a whole new avenue
it's an odd thing they found out. And because of this, David Dunn has become a scientist and worked together with scientists to investigate this phenomenon. And I think that there could be many more cases of this, musicians and composers working together with scientists, becoming scientists and working on these issues.
Mm. We're speaking with David Rothenberg, who's just published Bug Music, How Insects Gave Us Rhythm and Noise. It is the third and most disgusting volume in his trilogy about the sounds of wildlife, birds and whales in the first two books. You said before, it's one thing to sort of like go out and sample sounds and bring them into the studio and make something. It's another thing to actually go out, be with the insects, make music as we heard you do before. But you have taken samples of insect sounds and brought them into the studio and done stuff with them, right?
That's right. It's hard to resist because the sounds are so interesting. And we know that today more and more people are getting this fluidity at being able to change one sound into anything else. And this is something used to be very specialized, and now it's accessible to anyone with a computer or a phone. And so we're starting to learn more about this, and people are starting to understand how interesting it is to take one sound and turn it into something else and see what musical ideas come out.
So what are you doing with these engraver beetles? First of all, these are sort of related to those bark beetles you were talking about?
Yeah, engraver beetles are the kind of beetles that might be in a piece of wood you bring in, put it by the fireplace, it kind of warms up, you start hearing sounds from your wood. They've been alive there, it's getting warm, they're slowly munching it. And so it has amazing possibilities what you can do with it. And so this piece is the conclusion, the kind of loud thing. It's called The Year of Insect Thinking. What happened to me when I spent like a few years just listening to these crazy sounds and trying to think of them in musical ways.
This is from the CD that accompanies David Rothenberg's book, Bug Music. Rothenberg with some, I guess we'll call that electronic music.
If you actually read insect science papers, they sound like electronic music manuals. They're talking about oscillators and carrier frequencies and frequency modulation. This is what physically the insects are doing to make sound. They are like little synthesizers. And just as we now find musicians going back to analog synthesizers, you may find them going further back and using like bugs as electronic instruments and connecting them together. And I do have one recording, you probably have it somewhere too, of some guy using a live beetle as a mouth harp. He's going, and the beetle's going, it's from the Roots of Drone CD, which came out last year.
I missed that one.
That's like,
I missed the guy with the beetle in his mouth.
This is the direction we might be able to go.
David Rothenberg is with us on Soundcheck, musician, composer, philosopher, author of the books Why Birds Sing and Thousand Mile Song, which was about whale song. His latest book is called Bug Music, How Insects Gave Us Rhythm and Noise. And Bernie Krause, you talk about in the book briefly. He has this idea of these kind of natural symphonies where, insects have their own niche in the quote-unquote score. Where would insects be in that score?
Well, if you hear this wonderful recording that Bernie Krause and Louis Sarno made in the Congo of the Bayaka pygmies singing along. Women are collecting mushrooms, and they're singing along with the sounds of frogs, birds, and insects it seems like everyone's voice has a place in the acoustic mix. It's one of the best examples of that. And then you look at the sonogram, the printout, you can see everyone's got their own frequency. They stay out of each other's way. And so you have this idea that maybe as human music evolved, it was in the midst of these soundscapes and people knew how to sing their way into the forest. And today, you know, we create our own environments. You know, there's a lot we can learn from just put on a recording of how people were singing along with their environment and think, how could we do something like that in our society today?
A lot of traditional singing, you know, a lot of traditional music, very ancient musical traditions are all about sort of responding to, imitating the environment. Think of Central Asian throat singing and stuff like that, you know, the sound of the wind and all of that. Do you hear echoes of insect song, insect music in human endeavors?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I put together this playlist of all the things I could find that where insect sounds influence human music in a variety of ways all throughout history. And there are not as many as birds, but there's quite a few. And what's so remarkable is they're so different from one another.
So, of course, Flight of the Bumblebee, the Rimsky-Korsakov piece, is a good example. Your playlist includes the Harry James version.
I picked the Harry James version because
because you're a clarinetist.
Well, he's playing trumpet, but because it's the most it's just so funny. And I think what Flight of the Bumblebee is about is trying to get Western classical music to encompass insect music. You know, Rimsky-Korsakov is trying to get capture this bee sound in the chromatic scale. It's kind of ridiculous.
Harry James version of Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee. Harry James's big band arrangement of Flight of the Bumblebee. David Rothenberg giving us a playlist along with the CD that comes with his new book, Bug Music, How Insects Gave Us Rhythm and Noise. All right, David, let's come back to where we started, which is with the cicadas. What would you tell people to listen for when the northeastern brood starts making its appearance in a couple of weeks?
Oh, before you hear them, you're going to see these holes in the ground, little round holes in the ground, and the white nymphs will be coming up, and they'll come out like early in the morning and start to climb up the trees. And if you want to eat them, this is the best time to eat them before the wings sprout. They're more tasty and juicy, and you can fry them up. And
there's a recipe.
Recipe book on the WNYC website, I should add. It's not me that's spreading this stuff. And John Cooley, the scientist, says he's not a fan of this, what he calls a meme, internet meme about cicada eating. He says, don't do it. You know, we don't know what effect it'll have on the population. So
of cicadas.
I think there's millions of cicadas. They will win, but no matter how many you eat. But Cooley's the expert. He says, you know, don't go out there encouraging everyone to eat cicadas just because this is a
just
foodie
because you can.
Culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the first thing that happens, and then they'll climb up the trees and they'll gradually morph. The wings will appear, and they will become full adults, and then they will start to sing. And the basic sound you're going to hear is the pharaoh sound, pharaoh. Pharaoh. Pretty soon, you'll hear a few of those, but pretty soon there'll be thousands, then hundreds of thousands, then millions, and the end of the phrase will drop off, and you'll just hear like a tone, a single tone, like a drone around you. And when they're at their peak, if you're anywhere where they're there, it'll be hard to think about anything else or hear any other music.
I was just going to say, at what point do we lose our collective minds and civilization comes crashing down around us?
Well, it did appear on The Simpsons as an indicator of the end of the world, 17-year cicadas in an episode a few weeks ago. So it's spreading around. But this is also the best time to go out there and sing with them and try and make music and participate in this phenomenon, you know, because they've been eating underground for 17 years, ready to come up just to sing, fly, mate, and die. And you, too, can participate in this revelry.
David Rothenberg's latest book is called Bug Music, How Insects Gave Us Rhythm and Noise. Comes with a CD full of the sounds of insects in their natural state, electronically processed, playing with humans, all of that on the CD that comes with the book. David, great to see you again.
Thanks for inviting me on the show, John.
This is Soundcheck. That constant humming noise is going to be all too familiar here on the East Coast in the coming weeks as the cicadas begin to emerge from their 17-year underground party. And as we prepare for Swarmageddon, WNYC is running a cicada project, and you can find out more about our cicada tracker by going to soundcheck.org. And that brings me back to our question of the week. We're asking you, how do you block out noise in your daily life? How do you create a quiet space?
Hi, this is Deborah. I live in Jersey City, and I live right on a intersection with a bus stop. Every night when I get home, I put in my industrial strength earplugs. I pretty much shop for the best earplugs I can find. I found them, and I use those every night. If it wasn't for those, I think, I don't know what, I'd go crazy.
What about you? How do you block out noise? How do you create that quiet space? Leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612 or leave a comment on soundcheck.org. Up next, musicians and the neighbors who live next to them. Also, we'll hear from singer-songwriter Joshua James, whose new album we're streaming on soundcheck.org this week. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you're a New York City musician, finding a place to practice can be a major obstacle. Unless you have unlimited access to rehearsal space, you probably end up practicing in your apartment. And you probably have neighbors. Let's say your music sounds like this. Guitarist, singer, and songwriter Marnie Stern, and a song called, appropriately enough, You Don't Turn Down. It's a thundering track from Marnie Stern's great new record called The Chronicles of Marnia. Yes, she did go there. Now, when Marnie Stern wrote You Don't Turn Down in her apartment, she did, in fact, turn down.
I think the building was built very well and the walls are pretty thick, so you can play at a moderate level and no one can hear, which is rare. Friends of mine who live in Brooklyn, they can't play at all without it, you know, going through to the other apartment. The only drawback for playing is that you can't play extremely loudly because, of course, then people would complain. But I don't really ever have the impulse to crank it to 10 at 2 in the morning by myself and go crazy.
That's Marnie Stern performing and chatting in her living room, part of a short video documentary produced by Soundcheck producer Mike Katziff. If you're a fan of Marnie, you'll want to check it out, but you'll also want to watch the video just to see Marnie's unusually colorful Upper East Side apartment, which is equipped for guitar shredding, shooting music videos, operating an eBay business, and housing an adorable dog. Take this tour of Marnie Stern's apartment at soundcheck.org. Now, Marnie keeps her neighbors happy by turning it down, but WNYC reporter Arun Venugopal recently spoke with Upper East Side musicians who don't have volume knobs on their instruments. This was part of his series Micropolis, about life in New York.
One of my favorite things about this city is when I'm walking down some street and I hear a kid practicing their piano at home. You think of all the thousands of kids just starting out, little maestros in the making. I've never lived next door to a musician, though, and certainly never had to live with anything like this. Teresa Kim has toured the world and teaches students right here in her apartment on the Upper East Side. A while back, her neighbor, the mother of a newborn, heard her practicing this atonal John Corigliano piece and started paying visits to Teresa.
And she would say, you know, it just sounds like you're in my living room. Your instrument is huge. Can't you put a blanket on it? Can't you put a blanket in it? Like, do something.
Teresa only played during the hours allowed by her building and often practiced at her parents' home in Jersey, but it didn't matter. The neighbor lady kept returning, sometimes twice a day. She complained whether Teresa was playing a gentle nocturne by Chopin or something that made you feel like someone was just about to get murdered. And then the complaints stopped. The neighbor, it turns out, had moved away. Teresa still feels bad about the whole episode and is pretty sure her music forced her neighbor out. But she's not alone. In pursuit of their art, musicians have been annoying their neighbors and landlords here for decades. And often it doesn't end as smoothly as it did for Teresa Kim.
I know of one case where a neighbor even tried to poison the person.
Seymour Bernstein is a pianist who's taught thousands of musicians. He's even the subject of a documentary being made by Ethan Hawke.
Yeah, they left them something to eat at the door. Said, you should try this, it's a great... And it was poisoned. Yeah.
Seymour's in his mid-80s and has lived and taught in the same place on the Upper West Side for the last 59 years. It's a gorgeous ground floor apartment that looks like an old world salon, with all sorts of curios like the tea kettle once owned by Robert and Clara Schumann. In his book, Monsters and Angels, Surviving a Career in Music, he described in great graphic detail the fights he's had with both neighbors and the, quote, miserly Dickensian landlords he's had, like Henry, who he described as charging up the stairs like a bull bent on the kill while he hid inside his apartment.
Henry's rage knew no bounds, and in another second, he began banging with fists and feet upon my door, all accompanied by a spew of vulgarity.
At that moment, Seymour was scared Henry would return with the passkey, so he kept one hand on the door and another on the phone, ready to call the cops.
The whole time I heard Lillian trying to soothe her husband in the way that a serpent might hiss comfort to her mate.
This was in the 1970s. Seymour was repeatedly taken to court, but his right to play his piano at home and teach was repeatedly upheld. He in turn sued his landlord for $1 million and says he won $10,000. But the ordeal haunted him, leaving him sleepless and exhausted. That's not unusual. The piano virtuoso Richard Good consistently earns the highest praise from the press.
This is your life, this is your work, this is your discipline.
But even he's been told to stop practicing, in one case because the four-year-old in the apartment next door couldn't sleep. In another instance, the neighbor said his playing was absolute torture.
When you experience that, it's terrible because you feel everything that you do is causing suffering to people, and of course you feel constraint, and it enters your mind and also the body.
What's hard to say is whether this problem is more or less common than it used to be. Over the last 5 years, the total number of calls to 311 has risen by nearly 50%. But residential noise complaints, including loud stereos, wild parties, and practicing musicians, have actually come down by 17%. Still, some people think that a cultural shift has taken place. Les Marshak is a famous voiceover artist.
This is Today with Matt Lauer.
He grew up in the Bronx near Yankee Stadium. He said that as a young musician, he was a minor celebrity in his building.
There was a lot more encouragement and admiration for what we're doing, keep on playing. Nowadays, it's either, I heard the piano, you know, a little indignant. So I just think people are just less tolerant.
But of course, Les Marshak doesn't live in the Bronx now. He lives next door to the Guggenheim. His neighbors aren't just less tolerant, they're a lot wealthier. And one real estate attorney told me that increasingly high-end co-ops and condos are barring musicians from practicing more than a stated number of hours each day, and even limit the number of consecutive hours someone can practice. But even within these high-end enclaves, there are still high-end ways of resolving conflicts.
I was in the kitchen, and came a bang on the back door.
Ellie Shearing's the wife of the late George Shearing, the pianist and big band leader. She lives in the same building as Les Marshak.
And it was one of our neighbors. I had never met him, and I opened the door, and the first words out of his mouth were, "I can't have that noise."
Picture this. George Shearing, composer of Lullaby of Birdland. Sir George Shearing, who'd actually been knighted by the Queen, in whose living room you'd find guys like Dick Hyman, Mel Torme, Benny Goodman. Sir George was being called a common noisemaker. Soon, lawyers were called in, and they arrived at the Shearing home to see what kind of a racket he was producing. But instead of duking it out, the Shearings responded in the way of civilized folk. Photos of George meeting with various American presidents were strategically placed, as was Sir George himself.
He was in the living room.
Next to his Burzendorfer, the Rolls Royce of pianos. He was ready for the lawyers.
And he said, "I would like to invite the entire board with their wives to be my guest at one of my shows at the Carlisle," because he was playing at the Carlisle at the time. And he said, "And then they will hear just how loudly I do not play." And that did it.
That's how they roll on the Upper East Side. Ronan Segev is a pianist who also owns Park Avenue Pianos. Now he lives on Central Park South. The previous occupant was Leon Fleischer. But years ago, he was just another Juilliard student. His neighbor got so fed up of hearing Chopin's mazurkas through her walls that she started blasting Jay-Z right back.
So she buys this loud stereo system and would play this, you know, very loud rap music with a very strong rhythmic beat. So it would be something like, you know, a bomb, a bop, bop, bomb, bump, bump, bump.
But Ronan figured this was a good exercise. So we just played along, literally. Think of it as a mashup. Big Pimpin' meets Chopin. Big Pimpin'. We doing bum, bum, bum. This kind of musical combat happens all the time. People fight back with punk, with the Stones. Crank the speakers up to 11 and just leave their apartment. All that noise crashing about, and who knows, maybe 1 in 1,000 times something interesting comes of it. One of my favorite stories, and my last, I promise, comes from the mezzo-soprano Irene Roberts. She played one of the flower maidens in the recent Met production of Parsifal. A couple months ago, she was practicing in her living room when a bunch of middle school boys walked by, carrying skateboards.
I saw them go by because they're laughing and just making noise, and one of them stopped and was like, "Hey guys, what up, what up?"
Irene was singing an aria from I Capuletti e I Montecchi, The Capulets and the Montagues, a reworking of Romeo and Juliet. They heard her but couldn't see her, even though she was just a few feet away.
And he was like, "You hear that?" And one guy said, "No, no, 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 that can't be real. That can't be real. It's too good to be real." And one dude said, "No, man, that's it. It's too good to not be real."
The group stood there debating this for about 5 minutes, except for this one kid who wasn't talking. He was just standing on the sidewalk, transfixed, as if he'd never heard anything like it before. That, she said, was the best part of all. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is Micropolis. At WNYC.
You You can find a link to the Micropolis series on our website. And while you're there, watch our documentary exploring one musician's apartment, starring guitarist Marnie Stern. It's all on soundcheck.org. This week's Check Ahead comes to us from the singer and songwriter Joshua James. Beware is the name of his new EP. It comes out on May 7th, but we're streaming it in its entirety on our site right now. Here's Soundcheck producer Greta Cohn with more of the story.
A sheepskin for winter and a tin can for rain. I could cut you fresh ginger if you say that you're staying. I got a million more stories, only half are untrue. Here inside a Willamette Mountain.
Last year, the singer and songwriter Joshua James released an album called From the Top of Willamette Mountain. Willamette Mountain is a kind of mystical place of his songwriting imagination, but it's also very real. It's the name that he's given to his rural homestead in the town of American Fork, Utah. When I catch Joshua James on the phone, he's just returned from 7 weeks of tour, and he's happy to be back in his own bed. Because when he's on the road, he sleeps in some pretty unusual places.
Lord, we sleep everywhere. We sleep anywhere. We sleep in golf courses. We sleep under awnings of, like, abandoned schools. We sleep on people's floors that we don't know that we met at the show.
But just because he's home and in his own bed at Willamette Mountain doesn't mean there's much of a rest for Joshua James.
About 4 years ago, we bought about an acre, a little less than an acre of land. And it started off with chickens, and then it went to goats, then it went to honeybees, dogs and cats, you know. The whole animal kingdom. Noah parked his ark here at Willamette Mountain, so there's a lot of animals kicking around.
And right now, it's planting season on the homestead.
I got my seedlings in my grow station, my garden's tilled up, you know, I got new bedding for my goats and chickens, and I'm ready. I'm ready for it.
The spirits of Willamette Mountain. Well, I am not real. For you I feel, for you I feel. When the morning comes, I am not real. For you I feel.
Next week, in the midst of it all, Joshua James is releasing an EP of 4 brand new songs called Beware. Visit soundcheck.org to stream it all this week in our Check Ahead. Beware takes on some pretty personal themes. Themes that Joshua James has tackled in his work and his everyday life.
It's pretty blatant about the theme it talks about, which is kind of being raised as a religious boy and kind of the struggle of the concept of God and death. Struggles that I guess I go through, and so it's kind of just one of those things that I feel like maybe people can relate to.
The title track is probably the most revealing about the inner struggles that he says he's faced over his beliefs. Here's Beware.
Well, I lived in that town until I was 17. When I moved to the mountains that rose from the sea, where they taught me to pray each and every day. They said if I didn't, the devil, he would take me. And so I threw my hands up and I spoke to the Lord. I said, I'm a sinner, an apocryphal poet. It seems that God was in the ear, for no words did I hear. Could it be I was talking to no one?
I guess I was probably 22 or 23 when I actually started to legitimately study the religion I had my whole life deemed to be the one, the truth. And it's a scary thing to climb up the side of a building for 23 years and to get to the top to realize that maybe there's nothing there, that and to just let go and fall into the air and just kind of float there. And it's something that people can relate to. I'm not the only one that's going through, you know, this mental anxiety, I guess.
Please beware, in a mysterious way, God is here. Please beware, he's your pity, your pain, he's your fear. Please remember my is God who will take you from here.
But Joshua James says that he's found ways to explore his spirituality in a few new places. There's his songwriting, of course, but there's also the land and the cycle of life he sees firsthand at his homestead.
The whole concept of Willamette Mountain and with the animals and the garden and everything is what it does for me, and that's what it is for me, is it's the ever-living reminder that this is it, you know. Life is going on right now, and the moment, the current moment that I'm in, is the only one that really matters and the only one that I really have. And that's how I relate to spirituality, is the current moment.
There's one more ever-living reminder that life is going on right now for Joshua James, and that's the birth of a newborn son.
Baby Oliver arrived 5 days ago. It's been incredible. You know, I've raised dogs and cats and chickens and goats. I've never raised a human. So it's my first go, and we're extremely happy and excited and nervous, as you would expect. And it's wonderful.
This spring, Joshua James has two newborns, his son Oliver and a new EP called Beware, which you can stream all week at soundcheck.org in our check ahead.
A hand cut the dirt. Teeth the mountain, the hand cut the dirt, her teeth the mountain. She spit out the wind to run beside us. The hand cut the dirt, her teeth the mountain. Find me buried in a poplar field.
That was our producer Greta Cohn with the singer and songwriter Joshua James. Visit soundcheck.org to hear this song and the rest of his upcoming EP called Beware. And up next, violinist and singer Marquise Tolliver stops by our studio. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The violinist and songwriter Marquise Tolliver hails from Florida, but honed his chops busking on the streets of New York and East London, where he has created a compelling hybrid sound where pop and classical and R&B all meet. Fellow musicians on both sides of the Atlantic have taken a shine to him. Adele called him her new favorite artist, and the band Grizzly Bear asked him to record strings for their 2009 album Vekatimest. Now, Marquise is just a few weeks away from the release of his own debut album, Land of Canaan. We'll talk with him in a moment, but first, let's hear a song. Here is Marquise Tolliver, live on Soundcheck with Control.
Try to keep my mind busy on something, cops and trade, but there's no use, I miss my baby. No, feels like I've lost a friend. But the distance between us will not make me lose my way. Turn up your speakers if your baby's gone away, and let the radio keep playing. Oh, just let the radio, 'cause baby, you control my, yeah, my smile, baby, and I can't even hold it, no, inside, baby, because ain't no river wide, no valley low enough to keep me from getting to it, baby. Ain't no river wide, no valley low enough to keep me from getting to you. I'll search to find you, because I know that you're my home. Your love is better than silver and gold. Let the radio keep playing, 24 hours to go. Let the radio keep playing.
Nicely done. Marquis Tolliver playing the violin and singing. His song is Control, and you'll find it on his album Land of Canaan, due out on May 14th. Marquis Tolliver, my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. And I kind of expected, you know, there'd be more looping and stuff.
Sometimes I do that.
But you didn't really need it there. There's the moment where you're playing the pizzicato with the pinky finger at the same time that you're still bowing. So you got a couple of things going on simultaneously there.
I've had time to work it out.
Yeah. Now, it's kind of unusual. I can't think of too many other violinist singer songwriters other than, I don't know if you know Andrew Bird.
Yeah, we're on the same label, actually.
Oh, okay.
We're on the same label, Bella Union, in Europe.
In Europe, yeah.
But I don't know him.
Right. So how did you come to this? I mean, you're clearly a trained violinist. Did you take voice lessons as well?
Did I take voice lessons as well? Well, I went to Stetson University briefly to try to attempt a degree in music education.
Uh-huh.
So if you have the prereq for a music education degree is you have to, you know how to sing and teach singing and piano and all those things. So a little bit of that rubbed off. And then before that, I was just singing in church choirs and in gospel choirs. And then orchestra friends would get together before the bus and we'd like sing the latest Christina Aguilera song and like figure out violin parts to it and all this jazz. And so I guess it was a gradual manifestation.
Well, now, there's a moment in that song, Control, which, by the way, on the record is a much bigger sound.
Lush.
It's really lush. Although the same moment happens on the record, which is the quote from Ain't No Mountain High Enough.
Yeah, Ashford and Simpson, they created that, and Tammy Terrell and Marvin Gaye made it famous.
So I guess what I'm wondering is that, do you consider that part of your musical DNA? Is that kind of a...
I'd say it's part of my foundation as a contemporary musician.
Mm-hmm.
My intent as a musician is to bring together, I guess I can think of myself as a magician or a sorcerer in a way, and I'm just trying to bring together the different elements of vibrations from the past and fuse it with me, the present.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that that there's, even in the age where you can have a whole string section with the press of a button or a key on a keyboard, do you find people still being drawn to the sounds of real violins, real violas, real cellos?
I think so. It's just more of a quiet taste, because I guess if you're born in 96 and onward, you kind of gravitate towards the electronic and the sub bass and all those things. But for me...
How did you do that?
Oh, that Inspector Gadget. Yeah, watching Inspector Gadget.
You've done some string arrangements.
Yes,
I assume you did your own arrangements for, for the record, too, which is called Land of Canaan.
Yes, it is.
Can you explain the title?
Land of Canaan can be anything, but if you go on Google, I'm sure it will tell you what it is. But my Land of Canaan, this debut album, is just a fusion of the different types of places that have inspired me. Specifically, I'm from Daytona Beach, Florida, so the South, and gospel music is a big influence. Mm. And with gospel music comes church. So in church, you would hear all these stories of Noah and the Great Flood and the Curse of Ham. And those things were so vivid and crisp and jagged when it came to the adjectives and the stories. They resonated with me later on in the future when I was about 18 or 19 going to community college and had an African-American study course where we had to read the autobiography of Frederick Douglass. And that's where Canaan came up again, resurrected with Frederick Douglass recalling the songs that the slaves would sing while working in the fields. And the lyric is simply, "O Canaan, sweet Canaan, I am bound to the land of Canaan." Mm-hmm. And so I was so inspired by that, I created more words to go with it.
All right. We're speaking with Marquis Tolliver, the violinist, pianist, vocalist, songwriter. The album is called Land of Canaan. It comes out on May 14th. This song, White Sails, is not on the record. It's an earlier song from 2010, but here's a live performance in the Soundcheck studio.
Thank you. just a little boy swimming in the ocean. My past mistakes and future joys, I don't think I can swim this on my own. 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 Destiny fall down. Wipe away my past mistakes. The sun ain't shining now. I don't think I can make this place my home. Make this place my home. Make this place my home. Make this place mine.
Marquise Tolliver live in the Soundcheck studio in a song called White Sails. And that is just Marquise Tolliver playing the violin and singing an older song. It's not on the new album, but yeah, it's a lovely song. White Sails from Marquise Tolliver. May 14th is the release date for Land of Canaan. Marquise, thank you so much for being with us.
No way. Thank you.
Baby, it's a magic look.
Visit soundcheck.org to hear one more brand new song from Marquise Tolliver's new album, Land of Canaan, played live here in the studio. It's called Try Your Best. And that's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow night at 9, violinist and vocalist and composer Caroline Shaw is only 30 years old, but she's already won a Pulitzer Prize, this year's prize for music. We'll talk with her about the piece that won her the award. And the string quartet Brooklyn Rider performs selections from their eclectic new album, A Walking Fire, here in our studio. Join us then at 9. Thanks for being with us today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.